Well, you shouldn't believe anything that people say about turbulence anyway. So. Okay. Yeah, well, since I don't know what you know, I'm a little disadvantage here. I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about turbulence in MHD, and mostly I'll concentrate on strong turbulence. This is turbulence in which there's no perturbation theory even conceivably possible. And the main application that I'm interested in is application to the interstellar medium in particular, to try to understand the observations of scintillation of small angular diameter radio sources. So what we really see in the interstellar medium is a passive scalar, what we think is a passive scalar, which is the electron density fluctuating, and we think that that there's an underlying turbulent cascade. Now, the other thing special about what I'm going to talk about is I'm mainly going to talk about the inertial range in the limit in which the energy density in the mean magnetic field is much greater than the energy density in the velocity field. So the field lines will be almost straight, and there'll be little wiggles along them, which you can, if you like, think of as waves. Okay, so I start off with, more or less focused? Yeah. Okay, just tell you a couple things about ordinary hydrodynamic turbulence, which I assume that you all know about. Hydrodynamic turbulence is a sort of canonical behavior of fluids. There is? Oh yeah, good. In high Reynolds number, if you excite these fluids at some outer scale L, then as far as we know, there's a cascade of energy to smaller scales, which is characterized by a dissipation rate per unit mass, which is the outer scale of velocity differences across the outer scale cube divided by the outer scale. And you can get the Kolmogorov scaling, which seems to work pretty well for the inertial range of hydrodynamic turbulence, by setting the velocity differences across smaller scales, little l, by setting the velocity differences across these little scales, cube divided by little l, equal to the same energy dissipation rate. And that gives you a scaling for these velocity differences proportional to the one-third power of the scale separation. If you look at the three-dimensional power spectrum, then the energy per Fourier mode in the three-dimensional power spectrum goes as 1 over k to the 11-third. So this is very, very far from energy equipartition. And this inner scale, inertial range continues down to an inner scale where viscosity is able to damp the destroy the cascade. And that inner scale is equal to the outer scale, roughly divided by the Reynolds number, based on the outer scale velocity and separation to the 3/4 power. As I said, this is very different from equipartition, and if you have a steadily stirred hydrodynamic turbulence, the reason why you get this very out of equipartition distribution of energy as a function of wave number is that at the inner scale, the energy is converted into heat, and there's no significant cascade of energy back up to smaller scale. Of course, energy cascades from large scale to small scale, that's because there's more phase space small scale. It's not true of all turbulent cascades, though. Okay, now a couple of applications of this Kolmogorov hydrodynamic turbulence. One is for the mixing of passive contaminants. These can be used to make more even chemical reactions. If you have two interacting agents in solution and you want them to interact smoothly, then you can merge two turbulent jets. You can put two jets together. You can then get very quick mixing from the outer scale all the way down to the inner scale, and then molecular diffusion only has to go across the inner scale. It's known that the power spectrum of the concentration of a passive contaminant in hydrodynamic turbulence is the same as the power spectrum of the velocity field, although this is, of course, impossible to really prove rigorously. It's just obvious. It's impossible to prove rigorously because we don't have a full description of turbulence. As far as astronomers are concerned, an important application of the mixing of a passive contaminant involves the mixing of specific entropy in the Earth's atmosphere, which does behave, at least over substantial timescales, like a passive contaminant. And this leads to temperature fluctuations and essentially isobaric atmosphere, and therefore the refractivity, venti and then refractivity fluctuations, and that gives rise to the twinkling of stars, scintillation of stars, which is more an annoyance than anything else to observational astronomers, at least in the optical. To give you some feeling for how well established the Kolmogorov spectrum is, I'll show you first an experimental determination and then a computational one, which is now a little bit out of date. So anyway, here's the experimental result. There are many of them like this. Typically, experiments can give you almost two orders of magnitude of inertial range. Here's the slope 5/3. Here's the one-dimensional power spectrum. So instead of getting 11/3 slope, you get a 5/3 slope because you multiply by k squared, go from 3 to a 1 dimension. And this is against frequency, but you can figure this as wave number if you like. And this is sort of typical of good experiments these days. A few years ago, this was typical of a good computation. This is a 256 cube computer simulation. And you can see here more like one order of magnitude of inertial range, again, with a slope of about 5/3. This, I believe, uses a real viscosity. Use a hyperviscosity. For those of you who know about that, you can squeeze out a little bit more inertial range at the risk of tampering with the equations of motion. Okay, here's an application which is similar to some of what I'm going to talk about. This shows a shadow graph produced by the turbulent wake of a bullet. The bullet's all the way out here. What you're seeing here is, in the turbulent wake, the mixing of air that was shocked by the passage of the bullet, which has high specific entropy, with ambient air, which has low specific entropy. And then parallel light is passed through this wake. The refractivity variations then cause phase variations. This is all then focused, and these refractivity variations give rise to intensity variations, and you're seeing the intensity variations associated with this turbulent mixing of specific entropy. And you can imagine, if you were an astronomer and you were observing the intensity of this originally parallel light coming through this wake, and your telescope was moving with respect to the wake, or the wake was moving with respect to your telescope, you would see fluctuations in intensity. And so this is more or less the problem I'm going to be talking about with regard to radio waves going through the interstellar medium. Okay, so I'm not going to spend much time on the optics of interstellar scintillation, but I'll just show you one figure, which is a representation of data somewhat similar to what I showed you for the wake of the bullet, but a little bit different because there's frequency information here as well. These two are just two separate pulsars, so let's focus just on the upper one. Here what we're seeing is the time average intensity, averaged over many pulses, pulse periods of order a second for these pulsars. And the time scale here you see is measured in minutes of the intensity of radio waves detected from this pulsar as a function of time over a range of frequencies. The pulsars tend to be observed at lowish radio frequencies, in this case 400 megahertz. And if you look at any given frequency, like here, you see that the intensity is fluctuating as a function of time. But if you look at a fairly close neighboring frequency, just a fraction of a megahertz out of 400 megahertz away from the original frequency, you also see fluctuations, but they're uncorrelated. So here what we're seeing is a highly chromatic example of the type of diffraction pattern that I showed you before. Slightly different frequencies, you get independent patterns. And the reason for that is that there are very large RMS phase fluctuations built up for radio waves going through the turbulent interstellar medium. If you're interested in this, this is a very active, although somewhat specialized subject of astronomy.
What's the difference between alpha picture and...
There's two different pulsars. There's a lot of information here which I don't have time to go into, but for example, you notice that there's a systematic tilt here, and there's a different systematic tilt there. And those of you who really want to think about something else besides my lecture can try to figure out what that's due to while I get the rest of the lecture. It's understood, though, more or less. Okay, here is another piece of information that we get from the propagation of radio waves from small angular diameter sources through our galaxy. These are a set of hydroxyl masers that that emit narrow line radiation at 1612 megahertz. These masers are located near the galactic center. And these characters up here, they've done VLBI, well, have done, actually these aren't VLBI, I guess. These are probably VLA, right? This is VLA, salt waves, yeah. They've done interferometry to measure the shape of the scatter-broadened disk of these masers. So what's been depicted here is the ellipticity of the image that would otherwise be much smaller than this, if not for this scattering. And what you see is that these images are substantially elongated. And this tells us another piece of information about the interstellar density fluctuations, and that is that they're anisotropic. So we're dealing here with a passive content, well, we're dealing here with electron density fluctuations which are anisotropic, substantially anisotropic. Okay, here's a, there's a little poetic license in this which I won't bother to tell you about, but here's an image of a quasar. It's 6 centimeters, 3C279, a famous quasar because it passes close to the sun and it's been used for relativistic tests of bending of light by gravitational fields. This image was made when the quasar was at an elongation of 0.9 degrees from the center of the sun. The sun subtends half a degree in the sky, for those of you who know about that. And you can see, here's the image, again, a VLA image, these people, and you can see that the scatterbrain image is very much extended in one direction compared to the other direction. Again, a sign that the electron density fluctuations in the solar wind are very anisotropic. This direction is the direction away from the sun at the time that this was made. And so the implication here is that the electron density fluctuations were highly elongated in this direction. They were sort of like cigars in this direction that threw the image out in that direction. In the case of the sun, we have an advantage that we have some idea of the medium in which this scattering is occurring. Although in this case, it's very close to the sun, so it's not so easy to determine exactly what's going on. Okay, now I'm going to get on to my main subject. These are the equations of MHD, single fluid MHD. That's all I'm going to be talking about. And I'm going to furthermore restrict myself to the case in which the fluid is incompressible. So yeah, this additional equation. And the magnetic field here is measured in velocity units. If you know about these equations, good. If you don't, you're not going to learn from this lecture. There's some very interesting features of waves, of the waves that can propagate in a magnetized, conducting, particularly incompressible fluid, and they can be brought out by, instead of using the velocity and magnetic field as your dependent variables, instead using what are known as the Alsace variables, which are the sums and differences of these variables. And if there's more interest in the actual mathematical proofs of some of these relations, I'll come back to this view graph. Otherwise, I'll just tell you what the answers are. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you a little bit about MHD waves. In ordinary, in MHD, in compressible MHD, there are three linear wave modes. There's also an entropy wave, which doesn't really propagate, so I'm not going to talk about it, at least not right now. Two of these waves are called magnetosonic waves. They're slow and fast waves. They compress the medium, and they suffer linear damping by resonant particles, basically Landau type damping. And then there's a third wave type, which is a shear Alfvén wave, which is basically a transverse wave on the magnetic field thought of as a string. The shear Alfvén wave, at least in the linear limit, is incompressible even in a compressible fluid, and therefore it doesn't suffer from linear damping by resonant particles. In the interstellar medium, its main source of damping is damping by collisions of the ions, which feel the magnetic force, and the neutrals, which don't. So ion neutral collisions are the main damping mechanism. Now, when you go to the incompressible limit, the fast magnetosonic wave has infinite phase velocity and therefore can't be excited by any physical process, so you don't have to worry about it. It's like a sound wave in an incompressible fluid. You forget about it. But the slow magnetosonic wave still exists. Sometimes it's called the pseudo-Alfvén wave, and so does the shear Alfvén wave. And it turns out that both of them have the same dispersion relation. here's the dispersion relation. The frequency squared depends upon the field aligned. Remember, these are linear waves, and we take the field to be in the z direction, for example. Depends upon the field aligned component of the wave vector, and b naught divided by square root of 4 pi rho. So this is the dispersion relation. These waves not only have this simple dispersion relation, but they also have a very simple group velocity. Their group velocity is equal to a constant, the Alfvén velocity, which is just the magnetic field strength divided by 4 pi rho to the 1/2. And they're directed along the magnetic field. So if you think of the field lines, unperturbed field lines, as being straight, and you pluck some collection of them, then you're going to get a wave packet traveling with this group velocity up along the field line, unless you've been very special in the way you do the plucking. You get a wave packet going down along the field line that will pluck, and they just separate away at the Alfvén speed from the place that they were plucked. And here is the polarization for these waves, which will become important later. If the unperturbed magnetic field is along the z direction, then the slow mode has the displacement associated with it, which is also proportional to the velocity direction and the magnetic perturbation in the plane of the mean magnetic field and the wave vector. So everything here is in the same plane, the plane of the screen. The shear Alfvén wave, on the other hand, is associated with a displacement which is in a plane perpendicular to the wave vector and to the direction of the mean magnetic field. Now, the cascades I'm going to discuss become more and more anisotropic as energy moves towards higher wave number. And in the limit that you get very deep in the inertial range of these cascades, the wave vectors of the excited waves tend to become almost perpendicular to the mean magnetic field. And in that case, and this is important to what I'm going to have to say, in that case, the slow mode has a displacement or velocity field that's almost along the direction of the mean magnetic field, whereas the shear Alfvén wave has a displacement which is almost perpendicular, well, which is exactly perpendicular to the mean magnetic field always. So if you have many slow modes with all different wave vectors and many shear Alfvén waves with many different wave vectors, in the limit that the cascade is almost perpendicular, the polarizations of these two classes of waves are almost perpendicular to one another. Not only for the same wave vector where they're always perpendicular to each other, but even for an arbitrary collection, the wave vectors become almost perpendicular to each other. And that restricts the types of interactions these waves undergo in these perpendicular cascades. Okay, next I'm going to tell you a little bit about wave packets in incompressible MHD. These are all except for maybe 4 and 5. Well, they're all fairly well known. But I must admit, when I started working on this subject, I didn't know about sort of more than about half of them, and I actually thought I discovered one of them, and then I found it was in a book, but it's okay. I already talked about the two linear wave modes. Now, here's one interesting, well-known result from incompressible MHD, and that is that arbitrary nonlinear wave packets that are localized, these are localized disturbances, are exact stable solutions of the equations of incompressible MHD. So if you have a wave packet moving in one direction with respect to the field at large distances, it can have an arbitrary shape and it's an exact stable solution. There's no dispersion. It just moves along at the Alfheim speed. So it's already quite remarkable. Now that tells you, this number two tells you that only oppositely directed waves interact. So the only nonlinear interactions that you have in this system are collisions between oppositely directed wave packets. It's already a very big simplification. And then this is the thing I thought I had discovered, but as I said, was well known, and that is that in these collisions between oppositely directed wave packets, while the wave packets themselves deform irreversibly, the energies of the colliding wave packets are conserved. So if you have a wave packet going up along the field, another one coming down along the field, and they collide, after they pass through each other, they come out with the same energies that they had before. And this is a consequence of a conservation law which applies in incompressible MAC, which is the conservation law of cross-helicity. Conservation law is the dot product of the velocity and the magnetic field. So it's a very special. And then you can also show that the lowest nonlinear order, now this, all these are true to any order, but it's also, this last one is only true in a sort of perturbative sense, as far as I know. At the lowest nonlinear order, these waves follow the field line. So if you have perturbed field lines perturbed by waves coming in this direction, and then you have waves coming up in that direction, and the waves coming up in that direction follow the perturbed field lines. They're perturbed by the waves going in the other direction. Okay, so that's sort of the background. Okay, now I'm going to tell you the results of some work I did with a former postdoc of mine named Sridhar, who was here for months, six weeks. It's only a piece of what we did, and I'm not going to tell you how we did it. We sort of waved our hands over the equation because we couldn't solve them. And we derived scaling laws, which are sort of generalizations of Kolmogorov's scaling law for the hydrodynamic turbulence, but which apply to a case where you have a mean magnetic field, and where you have anisotropy. And then we then to try to convince people who worked in more technical aspects of this stuff, we took the equations of MHD, which I flashed up before, and we applied a standard closure, the EDQNM closure, and managed to sort of pull out from this closure the results that we had already obtained from the scaling arguments. Depending on your orientation, you may think this is an accomplishment or not an accomplishment. I would say it was an accomplishment of manipulation, but not a great accomplishment of science. Since I don't really think any of these closures, well, at best they give you a sort of feeling of consistency. If you can get out of these closures what you think you already understand, that's better than if you can't. But you would never want to consider this a proof of anything. Let me tell you what the scaling arguments are like. Now I should say, before I go into the scaling arguments for this strong MHD turbulence, that since we have a system here which has waves, you could imagine trying to look for a weak version of MHD turbulence in which the nonlinear interactions between the waves that were running up and down along the magnetic field were sufficiently weak so that the individual waves maintain their identity for many periods. And there is such, in fact there are two such cascades possible. It's different depending on boundary conditions. and they both have the property. They both have the property that these cascades strengthen as you go deeper and deeper into the inertial range. They both carry energy from large scale to small scale. So energy is carried to higher wave number. But these cascades strengthen in the sense that you need fewer and fewer nonlinear interactions in order to distort the waves as they get to smaller and smaller scales. And therefore, ultimately, these cascades become strong turbulence in the sense that the waves of small enough scale only last for one wave period. There's a very good example of this type of cascade provided by water waves on the surface of deep water. At any given scale, these surface gravity waves on deep water have a nonlinearity parameter, which is the mean slope, or the RMS slope, averaged over that characteristic horizontal scale. And if these waves are excited on long wavelengths by wind, for example, they can then cascade to smaller scales. And as they cascade to smaller scales, the mean slope of the waves at smaller scales becomes steeper and steeper. That is assuming that the waves aren't just spreading out so much that their energy density is decreasing. And so the cascade strengthens because the mean slope increases and increases, and eventually the waves break. There's even a theory for that. Okay. Now this this claim that I'm making without proof, which I could bolster up if you're interested, that the correct theory of weakly interacting, nonlinearly interacting waves gives a cascade which strengthens as you go to smaller scales. This is counter to the results obtained by Roshnikov and Creighton, which have been the standard in this field for many years. Creighton in particular understood all this stuff. And he made up a theory in which he considered wave packets moving through each other, nonlinear interactions among them, and he assumed that the turbulent cascade that would result from this would be isotropic. He explicitly assumed that. He implicitly assumed, by the types of scalings he went through, that the dominant interactions, nonlinear interactions, were those that coupled three modes, three-mode interactions. But he neglected to look at the closure relations for frequency and wave number involved in three-wave interactions. And if he had, he would have seen that those were inconsistent with the assumption of isotropy. And the Aroshnikov-Creighton sort of weak turbulence cascade is not like the one that I was just talking about, in the sense that it becomes weaker as energy goes to higher wave number. So it looks consistent from the point of view of getting weaker and weaker as the energy is carried to smaller scales. But that's because of this inconsistent assumption of isotropy.
Just 1 through 5, do they apply if you have to shear alpha packets interacting with
pseudo-alpha packets? These apply to all both modes. Yeah, that's right. But of course they do depend on incompatibility. So okay, so now I'll tell you the scalings that Sridhar and I came up with. Sridhar and I came up with these with a hypothesis, which we call a critically balanced cascade, that the linear time scale associated with the interactions of waves in strong MAC turbulence, that is, the ratio of the wavelength of these waves parallel to the mean magnetic field divided by the Alfvén velocities, linear time scale, was equal to the nonlinear time scale, which is given by the ratio of the perpendicular wavelength of these waves, that is, the characteristic scale perpendicular to the mean magnetic field divided by the velocity difference across the mean magnetic field. So this, if you take away the perpendiculars here, this is just the Kolmogorov result, that the eddies are critically damped, the nonlinear time scale is equal to the characteristic spatial scale divided by velocity difference across that characteristic spatial scale. Except to take away the reference to parallel and perpendicular. And this is a new element which has to do with the characteristic periods of these waves. So we're assuming here that the waves last of order one wave period. Not more, not less. And that this characterizes the entire inertial range of MHD turbulence. Now, once you make this assumption, for which we had a little bit more reason than I'm telling you, but not a lot more. I was completely convinced of it, though. We can make the same sort of argument that Kolmogorov scaling comes from, and say, I'm not sure whether Kolmogorov made this argument, but he certainly got it basically right. And we can set the energy dissipation rate per unit mass equal to the kinetic energy associated with velocity differences across scales perpendicular to the magnetic field squared. This characteristic velocity squared divided by this nonlinear time scale, we get the Kolmogorov scaling relating velocity differences across scales perpendicular to the magnetic field to the scale differences to the one-third power. So this is a 2D Kolmogorov spectrum. That's all it is. But we get something else out of it. We get out a relation between the parallel characteristic scale and the perpendicular scale for these waves. And that relation says that the parallel characteristic scale is related to the perpendicular scale to the two-thirds. So as energy, according to this, as energy is carried to smaller scales, so lambda perp gets smaller and smaller, so does lambda parallel. There is a parallel cascade. But the structures elongate more and more because the parallel scale doesn't shorten as fast as the perpendicular scale does. In particular, if you want to think of this in wave number space, this says that the wave vectors become more and more of these waves become more and more nearly perpendicular to the direction of the local magnetic field. By local, I mean the magnetic field averaged over scales of order lambda parallel. Now, this is a very interesting result, or a very interesting pair of results, because it says that even though this is strong turbulence, that waves only last for one wave period before being distorted out of by order unity, the bending, the local bending of the magnetic field that's produced by this cascade is very small. The local bending angle, if you want to think of it, but maybe the best way to think of it is if you have two magnetic field lines separated perpendicular to each other by a distance lambda perp, then they'll differ from being parallel. They'll be different from being parallel by an angle theta across lambda perp, which is of order v lambda perp over v alphane.
Gerstmann
is
taken
by considering
magnetic field largest scale or
what
scale lambda parallel. What is the other?
V alphane is from the total magnetic field. So this angle is lambda perp over lambda parallel, and that scales is lambda perp to the one-third. So as you go to smaller scales, if you look at the magnetic field on smaller and smaller scales, it gets straighter and straighter, more and more nearly parallel, according to this. And even though the field may be very, very nearly straight, you're still in a situation of strong turbulence.
Peter, with the Yeah. If you scatter energy out of this region of critical balance
right.
to higher K parallel, is it just that once you're at higher K parallel, you'll then weak turbulence and you don't change K parallel?
That's right. If you take the energy, yes, right. If you take the energy and you try to make these white packets more isotropic, then you weaken the cascade. But then we know that these weaker cascades always come back to strong cascades. So you're sort of stuck. You're sort of stuck on this. That was more or less the argument that you got this.
But 4 is really not a region, it's a line in K space or surface. And there is a region for which lambda perpendicular is much larger than, or lambda parallel much smaller than what is given by this relation.
Yeah.
What happens to this domain?
Yeah, basically what happens is you have wave, if you want to think of it that way, you can think of the perturbations as being wave packets which have characteristic width lambda perp, characteristic length lambda parallel, but of course this lambda parallel is just the shortest scale that goes along with a given lambda perp.
You explained that 3 minutes ago what happens to lambda parallel, which is much larger than given than 4. It just goes along chi perpendicular until it hits this boundary. That's clear. Now, what happens to lambda parallel? I just still consider K space as a whole. This is some surface of K space, like this.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
Now, what happens outside? You kind of.
There's very little power there.
Hypothetized. It goes horizontally. Lambda parallel doesn't change, lambda perpendicular increases because of the scale. Now, what happens inside? For lambda parallel much less than 4. Let's say I inject energy for lambda parallel much less than this estimate. What happens to this?
You mean if you actually injected the energy?
I inject energy into such. I mean.
Well, of course, if you injected energy from some external source, you would then start a cascade which had that as its outer scale.
I will cascade to large scales?
Excuse me?
I will cascade to
large
scales?
No, it's a smaller scale. It's a smaller scale. They just got to cascade to smaller scale. If you inject energy, it's a smaller scale. Uh-huh. It'll cascade to smaller scale.
Because you injected a lot of energy into essentially interchange rows, I think is what the picture is saying. Into entirely interchange mode, somewhere in the middle of the spectrum with reasonably high K power.
Yeah.
Would they smooth out into this sort of cone? How does energy get out of interchange mode?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by interchange mode.
One's the lambda parallel enormous.
Oh, you mean if you just had well, first place, you're doing that in both directions. You want to do that in both directions? With lambda parallel very, very large?
No, I want the lambda parallel small. Because
he wants lambda parallel small. Let me continue the talk and we'll talk about it after.
Well, I mean, 4 is a surface. Okay, it's a surface of K space.
Yeah, that's right.
But life exists in the whole K space.
Yeah, the energy density in these cascades. Where is it? The energy density in these cascades is confined to a cone.
You already talked about lambda parallel small picture.
You asked about lambda parallel large, and the answer was that then it is like Victorian almost small.
K parallel large. Lambda parallel.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. They talked about K parallel.
The energy is confined to a cone.
So it's
confined to so it'd be a cone with a perp and K parallel. Right?
Uh-huh.
So okay. it's confined to a cone like this. That's
okay.
All.
Okay. And now, I mean, 4 is the boundary of this region.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the boundary.
What happens outside and inside this?
Yeah.
Far from this boundary. Yeah.
There's almost no power out here.
But if there is power out there, it's become weak because the K parallel is larger.
Wait, I'm talking about
what happens in strong turbulence. I mean, there are other regimes besides...
Yeah, but energy must be scattered out there, and then it's brought back into the...
Oh, there's very little. You mean energy scattered?
I have an interaction between the triplet and modes inside.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Push some energy out.
Oh, no, very little. Very little.
But if you make some, if you have some...
Well, yeah, you can start with an excitation which isn't in this... You can start with an excitation which isn't in this regime.
I can pick three modes inside the cone.
Yeah, that's right. Well, if you choose modes for which the K perpendiculars are not similar. In other words, if it's not a local interaction in K space, you have a very much weaker interaction, but you can still get an interaction, of course. And so there is a little bit of energy dribbling out here.
Everything is cascading to the right. Outside the cone, it becomes weaker and therefore cascading more preferentially.
If you had a K parallel up here, that would be okay. That would be a great. What? Yeah, it goes that way. That's cool. Because it interacts with the same K perps. And it just moves along that way.
But
maybe when I describe it geometrically, you'll understand it more easily. It's not so complicated what happens to these long, long...
But the interchange is the one way inside the cone. Why do they spread out?
You mean if you have a very small K parallel?
Yeah, I thought that was what Richard was asking.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's okay. I'll explain that in a minute. Just let me get to it, though, okay? That's the easier part. I mean, there is power going all the way down to K parallel equals zero. Well, not in the finite computational box, but in principle, yeah. Because you just have these, what are roughly independent wave packets. So if you have a wave packet like that, and you look at... and you have many of them just totally independent of each other, then if this distance is 1 over k parallel, okay, or what we would call lambda parallel, then of course this is like a delta function to much lower wave number, and it gives a flat spectrum for all lower wave numbers. So there's power in all low wave numbers. And it's actually very important in the dynamics. But... Okay. The other thing that we deduced, although later, and which I'll show you some evidence for, is that the whole cascade is controlled by the Schirra-Alfvén waves. They cascade each other. The Schirra-Alfvén waves going in the opposite directions cascade each other, and the Schirra-Alfvén waves cascade the slow modes. The slow modes have only a passive role in these cascades. They're cascaded by the Schirra-Alfvén waves, but they don't themselves affect the Schirra-Alfvén waves. Also, if you have no slow modes in these cascades, you start it with a cascade with only Schirra-Alfvén waves, then the production of slow modes from Schirra-Alfvén waves is very slow compared to the time scale over which the Schirra-Alfvén waves cascade. So basically, even if the slow modes are being damped by, for example, resonant particle damping, and so they're not present in a realistic cascade, the interstellar medium, the Schirra-Alfvén waves don't really care about them. Okay.
Does the damping of this slow modes only weakens the coupling between the Schirra-Alfvén modes and slow modes?
There are two types of coupling. There's the cascading of the slow modes by the Schirra-Alfvén waves. That's independent of the damping. And then there's the production of slow modes by interactions among Schirra-Alfvén waves. And that's sort of independent. That doesn't matter on how much slow modes are present or whether they're being damped. And it's very, very small. I'll show you that. The Jason simulations show that really nicely. Okay, anyway. Okay, so now let me show you some pictures. First I'm going to show you some the results of some simulations by Cho and Vishniak, which are on APH preprints. There's more on here than I have time to explain, so let me just show you their power spectra and then their anisotropy determination. And then I'll show you some adjacent stuff. Okay, this is from a simulation in which turbulence was excited in a box. This is a pseudo-spectral simulation. Turbulence was excited in a box at a level where the kinetic energy density was just a little bit less than the mean magnetic energy density. And this is the power spectrum that was obtained by Cho and Vishniak. There are two power spectra shown here, one for the velocity field and one for the magnetic field. And this used a very high order hyperviscosity. It uses del squared to the eighth power for cutting off the high K power. That's why you get such a steep cutoff. Gives you a little more inertial range. It also may give you this flattened part of the power spectrum. That's what Cho and Vishniak said. But they just referred to a paper by Boru and Orsog, who found a similar effect in hydro turbulence. And I don't think anyone really understands it. Maybe somebody does. You understand. Oh, well, then you can tell me. Okay. That's good, because we don't see that. Jason doesn't.
It's reflection.
Well, we thought it was reflection, but we don't see.
It's called bottleneck, and I'm not sure it exists in MHD, but in hydro turbulence.
Well, it's less here in MHD. In the hydro, it looks almost like that. Okay, in any case, Jason only uses del squared to the fourth, and he doesn't see it. So, okay, and then here's the power spectrum. Whether this is k to the 5 minus 5 thirds or 3 halves, I wouldn't like to say. I don't think you can tell. Okay, so that's their power spectrum. Remember, here there was a large bending of the magnetic field lines at the outer scale of this turbulence, because the kinetic energy density was comparable to the magnetic energy density. Okay, and then they measured structure functions for the velocity and magnetic perturbations with respect to the local magnetic field.
The previous spectra was three-dimensional or two-dimensional?
One-dimensional.
The previous spectra was a function of K perpendicular or of the whole K, or it was two-dimensional?
Oh, no. It's a one-dimensional power spectrum, but what you're seeing is the energy against K perp. Against K perp, yeah. Okay, and this, so what they did then is they located each of the points in their box, the direction of the magnetic field averaged over some separation along the field and perpendicular to the field, and then they calculated the structure functions associated with the magnetic and velocity field components across these dimensions. And they made plots of basically the structure functions as a function of the longitudinal and transverse direction. And these show these plots. You can see here that as you go to smaller scales, things get more elliptical, less elliptical at larger scales. And then they plotted these intercepts. Down here to test the scalings that Sridhar and I came up with. And this shows the semi-major axes of these ellipses against the semi-minor axes. So this is 1 over k parallel versus 1 over k perp. And here's the prediction, k to the 2/3, and here's what they found. And this comes from different simulations, and some of these are for magnetic perturbations and others for velocity perturbations. So you can see reasonably good.
It's great, one that's really different from all the others.
This one.
Right. Why is it so different?
Yeah, I'm the wrong person to ask. There actually isn't enough information in their paper to be really sure of exactly what they did. So I know better what Jason did, although I'm not quite completely sure of that either. So let me get on to his results. Okay, now Jason Marone, who's here, is doing a thesis in this area, and he's a super computer, right? And his input-output with the computer is just matched perfectly. Unfortunately, I'm the thesis advisor, and his input-output with me has glitches in it. It's not clear always whose fault it is, but so I'm going to do my best to tell you what I think he did. Now, first let me tell you how all of this stuff works. Let's see if I can find this one more. Where are your magnetic field lines? Oops. I'm going to be missing one. Hey, how did this happen? Oh, here it is. Okay. Do you remember whether these are up waves or down waves, Jason? Down waves. Okay, there we go. So we put Jason up on the top. Now what are they?
We can erase that
out. Okay. Okay, this is from one of Jason's simulations, and it shows the bending of waves in his box, of magnetic field lines in his box, produced by waves that are going down along the direction of the mean magnetic field. And then, what Jason did is first, these field lines define a mapping of planes perpendicular to the z-axis into each other. You can imagine following each one of these field lines from one plane to the next plane to the next plane to the next plane, and that defines a mapping of these planes into themselves. And now, that mapping was that mapping was used to distort a bullseye, a colored bullseye as it moved up along these magnetic field lines. And here's the result of that. Now, we're missing the original bullseye. So we start with this, the first mapping, which is no longer the identity, but somewhat different from the identity. And we see, as we move away up the field line, what was originally a set of concentric circles of different colors has been distorted like that. We move up a little bit farther, it's distorted like that. We move up a little farther, it's distorted like that. We move up a little farther, it's distorted like this. Now the idea here, the reason for doing this, is that because these waves basically move along the magnetic field lines, wave packets, where it started at the previous location where this was a set of circles, as they move up along the field lines distorted by the downward going waves, suffer the same sort of distortion. And this is the origin of the cascade. It's just due to this mapping. Now, of course, this only gives the perpendicular cascade. This tells you how wave packets are shredded as they move up along these magnetic field lines. But there's a parallel cascade as well. And the parallel cascade arises because as these upward moving waves move along the field lines, they change the downward moving waves. So the back of a wave packet doesn't see the same downward moving waves as the front of a wave packet saw, because the front of the wave packet distorted the downward moving waves and therefore changed the mapping experienced by the upward moving wave packet. And in fact, if you do perturbation theory, you can show that this sort of distortion already shows up at the level of three-wave interactions, but the frequency changing, which involves the parallel cascade, first shows up at the level of four-wave interactions. Okay, yeah.
To what extent does...
Hey, I'm over time. Should I quit? How long do you go with these things?
Well, not normally an hour. Would you like to just go through it and then we'll ask you questions?
No, I don't care. It's just I don't have that much more to say. I have some more, and I want to show Jason stuff because it's really good. But I can take questions now. If you want to stay 15 more minutes, or I don't know.
Yeah, I just want to ask you.
Okay.
To what extent do these mappings quantitatively confirm your theory as opposed to just any theory you feel like was stochastic?
Our theory is not much of a theory, you remember. It says 2D Kolmogorov and lambda parallel scaling is lambda perp to the 2/3. It also says that the time scales for the linear time scale is equal to the nonlinear time scale. There's some parameter that should be of order unity and flat everywhere across the cascade. And when I tell you what Jason finds, you'll see about how well we do. This, of course, is just trying to show you in a pictorial way what's really going on. It's not a quantitative measure of anything. It does tell you one other thing too, which I'd like to get to. Okay, all of this distortion is dominated by the shear outplane waves. It's the shear in this mapping is coming from the shear outplane waves. Remember, the cascade is almost perpendicular. All the shear in that limit is coming from the shear outplane waves. There is a small amount of divergence or dilatation, depending upon how you want to look at it, which comes from the slow modes. But it's smaller by the anisotropy of the cascade. So if the cascade is very anisotropic, the dilatation in this mapping is smaller by the ratio of the perpendicular to the parallel wave number, which is very, very small. And it's that reason why the slow modes, which only contribute to the dilatation, are infinite in the cascade of both themselves and of the shear outplane waves. It's only the shear outplane waves that produce this cascading. And the slow modes just go along for the ride. They just passively cascade it. Okay, now you'll see, that was sort of Sridhar Subbaiah's last gasp of understanding from analytics, stuck in the end of our third paper. But then we come to the realm of the macho computer people who sort of put us out of business, or mostly out of business. Okay, so here I'm going to show you some of Jason's simulations. Now, Jason's simulations differ from those of Cho and Vishniak in a number of ways. First, he already starts with quite an anisotropic excitation. Okay, here we go. That'll take care of you. Okay, he starts with an anisotropic excitation in a box which is elongated, so the XY sides of the box have length here 0.002, and the Z length of the box has length unity. Its outplane speed is unity. Here's an example of a power spectrum he gets, and you can see that this power spectrum is flatter than 2D Kolmogorov. It's more like k to the minus 3/2. This is from a 256 times 256 times 512 power spectrum. This is from a single time realization, so there are not very many modes here at the low K, and this fluctuates around. You can see here he's divided the power up into two directions of shear alpha waves up and down along the field, and also two directions of slow mode waves. The forcing here has been done without any reference to mode type, so just velocities have been added to this with delta function correlation in time to this mean magnetic field. And here's what it does, a passive contaminant does. Passive contaminants in this case are a little bit more subtle than an ordinary hydro turbulence, because the waves, the waves are propagating up and down along the magnetic field, but the passive contaminant is just tied to the fluid. So it's being described by the mixing of the fluid, its spectrum. So that's a spectrum of sort of state-of-the-art spectrum. This shows from a much lower resolution spectrum. What happens if you stop after you've developed one of these 2D Kolmogorov spectra? Stop forcing and just watch decay. You can follow here the alpha wave in two different directions, and the slow modes in the two different directions. You see that this simulation, when it went into decay, had alpha waves in one direction with more power than alpha waves in the other direction. And that ratio of power in the two directions gets enhanced as the system decays. That's because the stronger waves cascade the weaker ones more quickly than the weaker ones cascade the stronger ones. And so the imbalance between the waves propagating in the two directions grows with time. And in the end, you have basically just shear alpha waves going in one direction left. You also can see from this that the decay time is roughly of order 1 unit time, which is the time it takes these waves to cross the box, propagating at the alpha speed. And that tells us that we don't have to worry about correlated information from the fact that the waves have gone around the box and met other waves that have gone around the box before the whole cascade is it's changed the spectrum.
The energy that's left with them is comparable to the energy difference.
Well, the energy difference at I don't think it's too much of a coincidence. It's because there's a there's actually, if you do a linear analysis of this with a simple toy model, what you find is that the differences in the square roots of the energy are a constant of the motion. So it probably isn't an accident.
I don't understand what's really important with the book.
This one or the one before?
The one before. You take, velocity field or scalar field, you make Fourier transform only with respect to the perpendicular coordinate, or you make Fourier transform both with respect to the perpendicular longitudinal, but just plot it as a function of
the
is the energy spectrum?
Okay, the energy spectrum is done by taking a Fourier transform with three Cartesian coordinates, then taking then summing the power in a fixed interval of kx squared plus ky squared.
But
so that's K perp. And then summing. And then integrating over all KZ.
So it's integral over KZ.
Yeah.
And it's taken in a point.
It's integrated over all KZ.
Just multiply by
K. Yes.
And the same with the scalar?
Yes.
So you can't quite discriminate between the Irish Nicole and your thing in the spectrum?
No.
Is there a spectrum you can't tell?
Well, you can distinguish a lot. But not from this, no, not from just this figure. But you could distinguish plenty if you see how anisotropic the spectrum is.
Purely two-dimensional, it looks self-contradictory, at least naively thinking, when you have velocity spectrum being less steep than Kolmogorov, then at that very velocity spectrum, you expect scalar to be more steep. there is some kind of complementarity. And here I see both less speeds than 5 over 3. Makes me, well, at least superficially surprised.
Well, actually, it surprised me too a bit, and I don't think we really understand it. I think in general, in his spectra, the scalar tends to be a little bit steeper than the velocity, but not much.
It's usually complementary. You have a relation of quantum flux of a scalar, which is really correlated like V scalar. And it takes you that the more scalar of V, the less scalar of scalar, and vice versa. So there is some complementary.
Yeah, but in this case, I believe it's a little different, but it's a little more complicated because the waves are passing through the, and they're not equal power in the two directions. And
but scalar don't care about waves.
Well, it does care about how much random walk there is in the actual velocity, in the actual positions of the fluid elements. That's what it cares about, right? And which is due to the waves. But anyway, we don't really understand that, so I don't. And also, in most of these, well, I didn't bring a view graph of that, but in most of these, the power in the two different directions of waves along the field is not equal. And that also...
In this case...
In this case, it's fairly close. Okay, let me show you two other spectra. Here's, that's not the one. Yeah, okay. This one shows the effect of the shear Alfvén waves on the slow waves and the lack of an effect of the slow waves on the shear Alfvén waves. So what's shown here is, again, this angle average perpendicular spectrum integrated over the parallel spectrum. Now, could you ask that? And what you see here is a spectrum that was produced first in a full simulation involving both wave types propagating in both directions along the magnetic field. And then Jason removed the slow modes, which were propagating up along the magnetic field, and he removed the shear Alfvén waves, which were propagating down along the magnetic field. So he now had a spectrum which consisted of a simulation initialized, which consisted of a spectrum of Alfvén waves propagating up along the magnetic field and slow waves propagating down along the magnetic field. And then he stopped the forcing and let it decay. And you can see what happens to the shear Alfvén waves. They're shown propagating up along the field. They're shown here. This is at t equals 0. And then as time goes on, the high wave number power in the shear Alfvén waves diminishes because of hyperviscosity damping. But there's no change. You can see a little change here, but there's no change at the low wave number part of the shear Alfvén wave spectrum, even though he's let this decay go on for of order a single decay time, a whole decay time. But the slow modes, which are propagating down along the mean magnetic field direction, t equals 0 gives their power. If t equals 0.5 gives their power, and t equals 1 gives their power. So you see, they diminish by an order of magnitude. So this shows that shear Alfvén waves cascade slow modes, but slow modes don't affect shear Alfvén waves. And the next...
quick question, does the slow mode spectrum have more energy at high k parallel?
No.
Okay.
The slow mode spectrum seems to be just like the shear Alfvén wave spectrum on average, you know, when you do these simulations. Okay, now there was one more. Oh, yeah. There's another one. This one's really remarkable, actually, how nicely it turned out. In this case, What Jason did is he took one of these fully developed spectra with both wave types propagating in both directions, and then he wiped out the slow modes in both directions, left just the shear Alfvén waves. So we had only shear Alfvén waves going in the two directions. He let the thing decay for a full decay time, so the energy dropped here by about a factor of two. And in both shear Alfvén waves. And he calculated at the final step how much power there was in slow modes, and it was all the way down here. Now this probably isn't even real power. This is probably due to his limitation, or the limitation of his spectral decomposition method to distinguish slow modes from shear Alfvén waves. So this is another example showing that at least in these perpendicular cascades that the very little slow mode is produced. So even if slow modes are being damped all the time by in the interstellar medium by collisionless damping, it doesn't affect the shear Alfvén wave cascade. Okay, now I have just one more thing I want to say. There's tons more stuff here, but everybody has to do important research. So let me just finish off with this. The application to the interstellar scintillation. This actually has a way to go, in my opinion. The connection between this and the interstellar scintillation. I think probably this is the right sort of path that this strong MHD turbulence is responsible for the interstellar scintillation. But remember, we see the interstellar scintillation only through evidence for this cascade only through the electron density fluctuations. We have to be able to connect these dynamic cascades to electron density fluctuation. And their problems involve with either trying to do this through the shear Alfvén wave cascade or through the slow mode cascade. If you want to do it through the shear Alfvén wave cascade, then you have to have something to produce density fluctuations, because the shear Alfvén waves don't compress the medium, at least to linear order. And so the only way you can get the spectrum of the electron density fluctuations to match the spectrum of the shear Alfvén waves is to have entropy fluctuations that are mixed by these shear Alfvén waves. But there's a big problem with entropy fluctuations on large scales in the ionized part of the interstellar medium, because entropy isn't a good conserved quantity on these large scales, because the turnover times of the eddies or the periods of the waves are very long compared to the cooling times. And in ionized gas, the temperature is always thermostated by electron collisions on metals. So you somehow have to get the entropy perturbations through the scales at which cooling is important, down to small scales. This is something that I've been working on for a long time, and I have a student working on. And, well, we're going to come up with what in astronomy is called a scenario for this, but I don't know how convincing it'll be. Okay, the other thing is that the shear Alfvén waves are susceptible. Well, not only those, but also the slow modes. They're susceptible to linear damping by even a small neutral fraction in the medium. And particularly because these waves are very anisotropic, it's not very difficult for neutrals to get in the direction perpendicular to the mean magnetic field. And since the waves have long periods, they have a lot of time to do it in order to damp the waves on one period. So you don't need many neutrals. So this cascade can only work in very highly ionized regions, such as ionized by very hot stars. And then otherwise, it appears that this cascade could probably extend down to somewhere near the ion gyro radius. And there is evidence from the interstellar scintillations that it goes down to very small scales, thousands of kilometers. which is somewhat bigger than the ion gyro radius, but not that much.
I don't understand that. Why are you saying that when we have, for example, mostly neutral gas, we cannot have this shear alternate?
Oh, we can. It just can't get down to...
Oh, yeah.
The cascade just can't get down to scales at which the scintillations are. The scintillations, I didn't talk about that, but the scintillations that I showed you an example of, those are produced by scales that are sort of 10,000, 100,000 kilometers. And that's way below the scale at which the ion neutral damping would wipe out these waves if there were a substantial number of neutrals. Okay, the slow mode cascade, Sridhar and I used to dismiss it because of the slow modes really don't even exist as a decent mode in the collisionless limit because of the collisionless damping. On the other hand, because these waves are so anisotropic, by the time you get to the collisionless regime, which is based on the longitudinal wavelength along the magnetic field, the perpendicular wavelength across the field is quite short, and short enough in many cases to contribute to the scintillations. So it's possible that the slow modes are responsible for the electron density fluctuations. But if they're going to be a good contributor to the electron density fluctuations, the plasma beta can't be that large because the relation between the magnetic perturbations associated with slow modes and the density perturbation has this factor in it of 1 over beta. And this may all seem rather vague, but in fact, when you try to put numbers into this, given the amount of ionized gas you have in the galaxy and the energy you have available to stir it up, you can't afford too many unfavorable factors and still account for the level of the interstellar scintillation. So this is a subject that really needs more work. Okay, I guess I'll quit. Yeah, Carl.
I had some questions about the last figure, the last paragraph. You say interscale larger than iron gyro radius. Is that the interscale set by iron collisional stamping?
Yeah, that would be the interscale set by collisional stamping, right. That's right. That's right. The sort of, in typical H2 region, collision lengths, the sort of astronomical unit. And of course, when the density gets higher, they get smaller. Somewhat smaller than astronomical units. So if you have an anisotropy of a factor of 1,000, which is quite reasonable in these regions, then you can get down to 10,000 kilometers in the perpendicular scale before you encounter the collisionless damping due to the power law scale. Okay?
Can the observations distinguish between H2 regions or shock fronts as the most likely sites of the situation?
I'm afraid that at present there isn't really a convincing story about where these scintillations originate in most cases. We're hoping to do some observations at Caltech, well, Palomar, this year to try to settle that because at least for the stronger scattered sources, I'm almost sure that most of them, you need H2 regions to give you enough scattering. And the H2 regions emit enough radiation and recombination lines in the infrared so that we should be able to detect them. And so what we're hoping to do is to correlate the strength of the scattering, which varies by many orders of magnitude along different lines of sight, with the amount of ionized gas, dense ionized gas associated with H2 regions. But there isn't really a very convincing case yet. Shock waves themselves produce density fluctuations just because of the jump across the shock front. But then you can argue, I think, pretty convincingly, and I think we have, that the turbulence behind the shock is much more important source of density fluctuations than the jump across the shock, basically in all cases. But there isn't a very good story observationally about where or what objects the scintillation occurs. In the most interesting case is the galactic center, where the scintillation strength is unbelievably high, especially when you remove the fact that material close to a source doesn't do as good a job for a given amount of electron density fluctuation in producing scintillation, or producing scattering of the angular diameters. And so there's some really interesting things connected with the galactic center, which maybe will come out of this eventually.
The vertical dependence of the
H2
between the conditions is different from the shock
gas distribution.
The O star is much more tightly compensated.
Yeah. Well, the sources that are strongly scattered tend to be towards the inner galaxy and at low galactic latitudes. You need a long path length, for one thing, in almost all cases. But of course, there is some variation, even for quite a lot of variation, even for closer sources. You could, and some people have tried, to look for closer sources which are anomalously scattered. Try to see what's along the line of sight. But I don't think a very good story has come out of that yet. But I'm betting on H2 regions. Not my house, but, you know, that is sort of plausible.
Yeah. Here to go a little further, and I guess some of the sources are so close that there can't be an H2 region along the line of sight, I think.
There is a low level of scintillation which increases in strength with the column density of electrons, with what we call the dispersion measure. And that's presumably due to what we call the diffuse ionized gas, and maybe some local clumping in that. For example, the local bubble. There's a story that the local bubble. Well, actually, I thought it was pretty good when I heard it. That the local bubble of hot gas that the solar system is in. That the boundary of that is actually an important source of scintillation to nearby sources. Actually quite a nice story. I'd say it's early days in understanding this.
Could a little bit of compressibility increase the interactions between shear waves and slow waves?
Oh yeah, I think it would, of course. And also it would break a lot of these special things like the exact solutions, stable solutions for nonlinear wave packets. Yeah, but my own opinion is none of this is going to matter very much, in the sense that since this is a strong cascade, the only things that are important are things that happen on one wave period. And you have to go a long way to get there. And for example, if the thermal pressure is a little higher than the magnetic pressure, the medium is already effectively incompressible. After all, incompressible turbulence works reasonably well in the atmosphere, as long as your Mach number is modest. And here, when we're dealing with this deep inertial range, energy densities and the fluctuations are tiny. So my guess is basically all this stuff is all going to be okay. And a lot of other things that affect the observation, like the fact that somewhere along the line, in fact, there will be too many neutrals, and you will have cutoffs in the spectrum, and the spectrum will be very steep, and that gives rise to caustics, and there'll be all sorts of stuff like that, and the mean spectrum won't be exactly, but I don't think compressibility itself is such a big deal. Now, Now, of course, if you're interested in anything that has to do with out-of-scale dynamics, what I talk about isn't really irrelevant. Except to the extent that, this type of spectrum may be important in reconnection. Because there you can get big effects on large scales from behavior at small scales. But if you're interested in star formation or something like this, this stuff's not going to be very important. This is scintillations and maybe reconnection. So, there's an absolute proof that the magnetic field is important in this, which I forgot to mention. And that is that without the magnetic field, all the electron density fluctuations that are involved in the scintillation couldn't possibly exist, because the mean free path for Coulomb collisions is very much longer than these scales. And so everything were just phase mix away. So it's absolutely essential that there be a magnetic field. It doesn't have to be that strong, but it's absolutely essential. And did it be, reasonably volume filling? But we knew that anyway. Okay.